ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, this is Julian Morrow with you, saying thanks for tuning in to The Making of One Nation, Episode 4, Move the Centre. This episode looks at how a party that's never been the government or even the formal opposition has managed to exert such influence on the public policy agenda of Australia. The host of The Making of One Nation is Ashlyn McGee, the Head of Editorial Innovation at The Conversation, and it's presented here by ABC Radio National. And now it's over to Ashlyn McGee.
Okay, so stay with me here. One Nation has never held government. It's never been in opposition. It once had a smidge of influence in the Senate, but it's never properly even held the balance of power. And yet, it still managed to influence public policy for three decades. Borders, immigration, Indigenous affairs, multiculturalism, it's moved the needle on each of these issues. But how? Surely it takes more than shouting the loudest about the most divisive issues. I'm Ashlyn McGee from The Conversation, and this is The Making of One Nation. Episode 4, Move the Centre. In this episode, we're going to do things a little bit differently. We're joined by two guests. Tim Bale, a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, who's been keeping a really close eye on One Nation. And Josh Sunman, who lectures in public policy at Flinders University. Josh, you've also been keeping an eye on One Nation for quite a while. What is it that makes the party so interesting to you?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a South Australian by blood. So obviously at the moment, One Nation have just had their surge through in the South Australian election. And this is something that obviously I've been watching really keenly. Seeing these things come about in South Australia in real life, it's kind of confronting, but it's also fascinating.
Is it fair to say One Nation's had an outsized influence on policy, given it has never governed and never really had that many seats in Parliament?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? When we have a look in kind of global terms at the populist right, a lot of their influence comes from their potential to be a governing partner or at least disrupt governing coalitions throughout Western Europe. In Australia, that hasn't been the case. One Nation hasn't had a massive parliamentary presence, but it still has had a lot of impact upon political discourse and the positioning of other parties. If we think historically, One Nation had a big impact around immigration and asylum seekers.
I and most Australians want our immigration policy radically reviewed and that of multiculturalism abolished.
This was a period where One Nation was seen as insurgent, particularly kind of biting into Liberal, but also traditional working class Labor support. And John Howard, the Prime Minister at the time, was incredibly adept at taking on a lot of One Nation's messaging and policy positions, but trying to package and mainstream it as kind of a more moderate position. Now, we do have to acknowledge as well, the coalition, particularly under Howard, had always had these kind of views. Howard in the 1980s, for example, spoke of Asian migration and cutting it down, and then was kind of lambasted by both his party and the Labor Party and the press for it. But then it was interesting to see how by the end of the 1990s, that window had moved. One Nation was a part of that. And, you know, we can kind of capture this in Howard's famous, "We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come."
"Who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come."
We can really see him making a play for the One Nation vote there. And really, One Nation's influence has been seen throughout kind of asylum seeker policy in particular ever since. The Labor Party has also broadly adopted the kind of positioning of Howard, which is no boat arrivals should be settled in the country. They had their own kind of Timor solution under the Gillard government.
"The Prime Minister Julia Gillard has moved to seize the initiative on the asylum seekers issue by announcing plans to set up an offshore processing centre in East Timor. While the Greens and some refugee advocacy groups have slammed this as a direct steal of the Howard government's Pacific solution, the government..."
So there's a real kind of sense that One Nation has shifted the dial right on immigration, but that's not to say those attitudes weren't there to some degree anyway.
Josh, let's talk through the mechanics of it. How exactly does One Nation influence policy?
Yeah, so it's not a one-to-one thing. It's not as if One Nation go, this is our policy, and the major parties go, that's an incredible idea, we want to do that. It's this sense of electoral positioning. So once the major parties get a sense that One Nation's really simplistic messaging, particularly on immigration, is biting through, they then feel a need to bring back those voters who they're worried about losing to One Nation. And so they offer a kind of moderatized, kind of sanitized version of what One Nation's policy position is, even though the substance is largely the same. I think a really helpful term here is mainstreaming, right? And mainstreaming refers to this idea of bringing in either a party, an actor, or ideas which were previously seen as untouchable or completely unacceptable, and bringing them into the kind of mainstream political discourse. They become more accepted and acceptable. There are three major actors which work in this mainstreaming process. There's the establishment parties, so Liberal and Labor. There's One Nation itself, but there's also the media.
So if you're the Labor Party right now, how exactly do you counter One Nation?
Yeah, it's tough, right? I think the Labor Party is looking for an answer to that, because whilst, you know, we've seen a massive amount of vote transfers from the coalition to the One Nation, we're starting to see it eat into the Labor vote as well. That's really evident in the polling. So if you're the Labor Party, I think you have two broad approaches. Number one would be the classic social democratic answer. This would be, we need to address the material insecurity, cost of living crisis, housing crisis that is driving people to look for simple solutions to really complicated problems. For One Nation, cost of living, housing crisis, energy prices, it all comes back to there are too many people here, we need to turn down immigration. And that offers what we call in populist scholarship a common sense response, right? People go, oh yeah, that sounds right, even though the real reality is far more complicated. Number two, we've actually seen from Peter Malinauskas in the aftermath of the South Australian election, he's talking about reclaiming the flag in some kind of way. He's talking about, you know, as a left-leaning party, we shouldn't be abandoning the kind of Australian flag and conceding that to One Nation. We should have a kind of inclusive patriotism. This is what he's trying to kind of chart a path on. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
So we're now talking about One Nation as a potential opposition party or an opposition force in Australian politics. What actually happens when the fringe becomes truly the mainstream in that way?
It's very hard to say that a party is on the fringe when it captures 22% of the vote and overtakes one of the major parties. But we got to remember, this is a process of kind of legitimisation and mainstreaming that started long before this electoral breakthrough. There were kind of concessions from the major parties, number one, on One Nation's kind of policy areas, but also in how they were treated as a political actor. And we're going to continue to see that, I think, if history's a pattern. We're going to see the major parties engaging with One Nation in a more kind of serious way, and that helps their long-term legitimisation. If I was the Liberal Party, I probably wouldn't engage in this. I would probably want to make it so One Nation was on the outer, so that we were the legitimate party of kind of centre-right opposition. However, they're scared of alienating those potential voters who they've lost even further. So as a party of opposition, it'll be interesting to see One Nation's role going forward.
You know, Josh, even just listening to you and I talk just now, there's this sense of almost like a bit of detachment, like let's just see what happens and what an interesting kind of thing this is to observe. But if we zoom out, how does this change Australian politics?
I think if we zoom out a bit, we've seen now a major party for the first time has slipped behind a third party challenger. I think that's a massive part of the story. That's a massive psychological blow to the Liberal Party and the party system as a whole. And it's also part of this broader story. One Nation is surging at the moment, and they're picking up a lot of votes, particularly from the coalition. But this is a story going back to 2022, 2019, where we started to see voters really move away from the major parties towards, you know, initially it was Teal Independence. Now we're seeing the rise of One Nation. I think this is a broader story of disaffection in Australian politics, and One Nation are just one chunk of that. They're the chunk that we're interested in because it's happening right now. But there's this overall sense of disaffection and lack of representation from the major parties. And this is really what's driving this One Nation surge.
After the break, it's not just Australia. How populist far-right figures are shifting the dial the world over. Tim Bell, you're a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, and you've been a close observer of far-right politics over many years. So this ability to influence policy from the outside, it's not a unique thing in Australia, right?
Well, the UK is a very good example, really, of a populist radical right political entrepreneur, Nigel Farage, of being able to scare, in particular, the Conservative Party, but not just the Conservative Party, also the Labour Party, into far more restrictive policies than would otherwise, I think, have been the case on both asylum and migration.
We have got to turn this country around. We've got to control our borders.
So, for example, during COVID, Nigel Farage made a very big deal of people coming across in small boats from France through the English Channel. That got picked up by the media.
Yesterday, 35 more migrants crossed the English Channel, bringing the numbers that we know of to 521 that have come across the Channel since our lockdown began. They're coming, of course.
And it prompted the Conservative Party to talk in very, very tough terms about trying to do something about that situation. And that, in part, lost the Conservative Party the election in 2024. But we then got a Labour government which has consistently hardened its line on immigration and asylum. And I think without Nigel Farage, you'd have to say that although, you know, you might have seen some movement in that direction, you wouldn't have seen quite the kind of hysterical rhetoric around the issue, and nor would you have seen policy move so fast. In some ways, the United States of America is the paradigmatic example of a party which has been, if you like, captured from the inside by the populist radical right. What you had was a series of movements, beginning with the Tea Party and then the kind of MAGA movement, which, if you like, at the host, the Republican Party, from the inside. And you now have a situation in which essentially the populist radical right is running the Republican Party. But I don't think that is completely unusual. You do see that, for example, in Hungary. You see that Fidesz, which was the party run by a guy called Viktor Orban, gradually becoming a populist radical right party and transforming itself from what was, you know, a reasonably kind of liberal centre-right party a couple of decades ago. And many people would argue that, in fact, what you see in Britain is the Conservative Party going in that direction as well.
So people talk about this concept of fringe parties winning by losing. Explain that to me.
Winning by losing effectively refers to the fact that although populist radical right parties don't necessarily get into government, don't even necessarily make it into parliament on some occasions, do sufficiently well to worry mainstream parties enough to encourage them to try and alleviate the threat by aping the rhetoric or adopting the policies of the populist radical right. So it's not necessarily the case that you have to get into government, you have to run a country in order to be able to influence policies in pretty powerful ways. I think it's also important to realise that mainstream parties are often willing to do deals at the electoral level and indeed at the governmental level with populist radical right parties, which further normalises and legitimises them. So you have situations in many European countries where, at least at the subnational level, you will get coalitions and you also get agreements to stand down candidates or to, as in Australia, allocate preferences to each other. Sometimes that can be formal in some countries, sometimes it can be informal. So you'll get tactical voting between mainstream conservative parties and populist radical right parties. And that's part of this wider normalisation normalisation and legitimisation of the populist radical right.
So if I was a lobby group, if I was a vested interest, if I had money to burn and wanted to donate it to a political party, it seems like this could be a pretty good way to get what I was after in politics, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do often find that there are civil society organisations, think tanks or whatever, that are allied and not necessarily officially to those parties. They move the media conversation in their direction. They are often the sponsors, if you like, of events, of publications, etc., creating a kind of ecosystem in which those parties operate and to some degree thrive. So I think if you are someone with ambitions in that direction, at least to move policy, then you're not just going to be supporting that party. You're going to be supporting the wider network in which that party operates and which it becomes, if you like, the tip of the spear. How to counter the populist radical right is a dilemma, a conundrum that mainstream parties of both left and right have been facing for a couple of decades now. And to be honest, there aren't very many examples of success. There is a tendency on the part of those mainstream parties to think that by adopting some of the rhetoric and some of the policies of populist radical right parties, that they will be able to persuade voters that they have solutions to some of the problems those parties bring up. But actually, all that happens is that they raise the salience of those issues. They make them top of head for voters when they go into the polling booths. And they end up voting for the real thing rather than the copy. If there is a solution, then it is probably to try and move the agenda off the signature issues that benefit those parties. Quite frankly, both parties and political scientists have been looking for some time for some kind of silver bullet which might kill the populist radical right and have been completely unable to find one. And I think it's important probably for people no longer to start hoping that somehow these parties can disappear and instead regard them as a fact of life in politics. So in other words, they're no longer a kind of pathological part of the political system. They are a normal part of the political system all over the world, for good or ill.
Tim Bale and Josh Sundman, thanks so much for your time.
No problems. Great to be with you.
Happy to help.
You can read more from both Tim and Josh at The Conversation. This is the fourth episode in our series, The Making of One Nation, and we'll have new episodes each week. So make sure you follow the show and please leave us a review. It does really help others find us. This episode was produced by Isabella Podwinski, sound designed by Michelle Macklem. Our head of editorial innovation is me, Ashlyn McGee. Misha Ketchell is the editor of The Conversation Australia. A special thanks to our colleagues Gemma Ware, Justin Bergman and Amanda Dunn for their ideas and wisdom. The Conversation is a not-for-profit media organisation. You can sign up to our free daily newsletter by clicking the link in our show notes. And you can also listen to more of our shows wherever you get your podcasts.
You can catch the next episode of The Making of One Nation live on your radio next Sunday morning on ABC Radio National just after 7:30 a.m. as part of Sunday Extra with me, Julian Morrow. New episodes also drop weekly in this feed, or just search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you can join us soon for Master the Media, Episode 5 of The Making of One Nation.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.